Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. You know, nobody knows what that final destination for human beings consists of, but there is a stopping place along the road to whatever happens after we die, and that is the cemetery. My guest today has written a splendid book. It's called 222 Cemeteries to See Before You Die, and it is anything but depressing. It's a fascinating, eye-opening book at burial places around the world. Her name is Lauren Rhodes. Hey, Lauren, welcome to the Fromer Travel Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I don't want to give away what your email address is, but it has to do with cemeteries. How did you get, can I say, obsessed with this topic?
Well, but totally by accident, which I think is how most people get into it. My husband and I were traveling to Europe for the first time, and we ended up unexpectedly in London. And one of the things I came across was this beautiful book of photographs of Highgate Cemetery. And oh my goodness, we went on a January day, we had the place to ourselves, and it was just magical. You know, angels completely enshrouded in ivy. And I decided I needed to see more of this. You know, I fell in love with the sculpture first. And so the second half of our trip was going to Paris, and we went to Père Lachaise. And, you know, that
was
it.
Which is another, an extraordinary place to go. So in this book, you start with the old burying ground in Kittery, Maine. Why does that get the honor of being the first cemetery in this book?
Oh, that's a good question. I wanted to do the book in kind of geographic segments, just to make it easier for people as they were traveling. And it made sense to start at the top and work my way down. So that cemetery has a headstone of a ship that was lost at sea. And It's just this beautiful piece of artwork with a little story that would be lost, you know, more or less, except for there it is in the cemetery. And all the cemetery books call it out. So
would you mind telling us what the story is?
Well, I know it's the Hattie Eaton, lost March 21st, 1876, with a crew of eight and one stowaway. Six of the bodies went unclaimed, so the townspeople buried what was left there, and the gravestone is engraved with a storm-tossed ship. And I just love the idea of this ship remembering these people. Even though their names are lost, the story continues.
Yeah. And often when you go into a cemetery, there are symbols in the cemetery that I think past generations knew better how to read than we do. Can you tell us some of the common symbols you'll see in a cemetery and what that might mean?
One of my favorites is a broken rosebud, and that symbolizes a child that was lost too soon. And there's a whole list of spin-offs of roses and what the roses mean. You know, sometimes they're the Virgin Mary, sometimes it's a mother. Sometimes you'll see a gravestone with a fully opened rose and, you know, two buds if the mother and both children died at the same time. So, you know, once you start to poke into it, you can learn a lot from what's basically a mute rock.
Right. Yeah. So one of the cemeteries that you profile in the book is God's Acre Moravian Graveyard in North Carolina. I think it's Winston-Salem. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize, first of all, that the Moravians were the very first Protestant sect. And the way they buried people in a Moravian cemetery says so much about their worldview and mm-hmm. their ethical, their ethical tenets. Can you talk a little bit about how a Moravian cemetery is organized?
It's fascinating. They separate men from women. They separate married women from unmarried women. And they're buried not in family groups, but as they fall. And so the stones are arranged in death date order. Mm. And I discovered that place because I collect cemetery postcards, just because I think the concept of cemetery postcards is really strange. And yeah. They do an Easter ceremony at the graveyard. The entire congregation comes to the graveyard. They decorate all the stones with flowers. And it's lovely. But it's one of those things that I would never know about if I hadn't started poking into cemeteries.
Right, absolutely. And the stones there are far more plain than mm-hmm. they are in other cemeteries. Why is that?
A lot of different religious organizations have felt that the iconography and the statuary and all of that was grandiose. And the point in the Moravian cemetery is all of them are equal. So they all have exactly the same stone with exactly the same kind of information. Nobody's called out as a beloved mother or something like that because they're all beloved. And I think that's kind of beautiful that yeah. they've just recorded their beliefs right there in stone.
Absolutely. And not only is nobody called out, there's no differentiation between the grandness of a male grave or a female grave. I mm-hmm. thought that mm-hmm. also was really striking.
No difference between rich or poor, which is something you often see in cemeteries.
Right, right. Now, you also talk about sites that some people may not think of as cemeteries, mm-hmm. But that are, and probably one of the most famous grave sites or tomb sites on the planet, the one that Christians believe Jesus Christ walked away from, mm-hmm. is in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. And just the history of how that church came to be is so fascinating. Can you tell that story?
It is an amazing place. In the Bible, the story is told that Christ was buried in a borrowed tomb. And when the angels came, it was empty. Believers came. The tomb was empty, and there was an angel sitting there and saying, "Why are you looking for him here?" And that was lost for years and years. When the Crusaders first started to come to the Holy Land, they decided that this tomb was Christ's tomb, and they built a church over it. And over the years, people coming to visit the grave would chip the rock away. And so it was kind of fragile. At some point, they clad the whole thing in marble so that nobody could carve on the rock anymore so it wouldn't collapse. There isn't really any evidence that this was Christ's tomb, but there's thousands of years of belief that makes it holy. And I'm just fascinated by that. It was just refurbished, I believe, in 2016 yeah. with money from the World Monuments Fund, and they've taken the cladding away, and so you can see the actual rock now. But
do you know, was there any surprises in seeing the actual rock? Because it is astonishing to think that in 2016, people got to see something that's been covered up for hundreds of years.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's a Smithsonian, I believe, documentary about it that's really worth finding. I think that's on the Disney Channel.
Wow. Yeah. And going back almost as far, you talk about what is an archaeological site mm-hmm. in the Burren, which is one of my favorite parts of Ireland. It's this limestone plateau that, because of the way the winds are, gets wildflower seeds from across Europe and also across Africa. And so when you're there, as I was several years ago, you see blossoms from all over the world. And it's just extraordinary. And in these fields of blossoms, there are these ancient dolmen, which are two or more massive stones going up with kind of a slate stone at the top. And archaeologists have been digging up these ancient graves. And what did they find underneath the, I hope I'm going to pronounce this right, the Poulnabron Dolmen in Ireland?
Oh, it's fascinating to me. I knew it had been a tomb at some point, and it had been covered over with ground. You know, the bare rocks that we see now were not what was originally built. But over the years, all that sod has washed away. And I didn't, when I started the research, didn't think that there would be anything left. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of years, but they did find
thousands of years, right? I mean, yeah, people were buried there 2,000 years ago or so.
And they found fragments of bone. People had been cremated and their ashes, the remains buried there. And some of them had like arrow points embedded in the bone. So you could see how these people died all these years ago. That there was anything left, I think, is magical. And there were pieces of jewelry, pieces of pottery, a little bit of remnants of the past. I mean, one of the things I think is really interesting about studying graves is a lot of what we know about the past comes from burial sites, from archaeology. And you know, things that would be lost, that we would never know what people ate, what people wore. All of that would have been lost, except we've opened these graves over the years.
Yeah. And something stunning about these graves is there was nobody over the age of 40 in them.
Yeah.
People died far younger than they do today when they were on the damn paleo diet. And
yes.
The other thing you say about this grave is they've found similar ones in terms of the construction of it in far-flung places.
All
places
around the world.
Nowhere near Ireland.
Exactly.
What are the theories behind that, beyond aliens coming to Earth?
Yeah, I don't hold with the alien thing, but I do think that in the past, taking care of a dead body was a pressing concern. And the ways to take care of a dead body are kind of limited. You can cremate it. You can do sky burial, as they do, the Zoroastrians did.
Sky burial is when you put it outside so the birds can
eat
get it.
Yeah. Or burial. And burial is common in a lot of different cultures around the world, kind of spontaneously, because people needed to take care of their dead and make sure that they weren't going to be contagious or come back. So it's fascinating to me that you find dolmens in Spain and South America, you know, all these different places that had no possible way to connect and share this idea.
Yeah. Astonishing. Really astonishing. You also talk about the Necropolis de Cristobal Colón, which is Christopher Columbus to all of us, which is in Havana and gets more visitors than almost any tourist site in all of Cuba, even though the government there has not maintained this cemetery well. That's not part of their mandate. Tell us a little bit about that cemetery. Just from a cultural standpoint, I thought that was really remarkable.
Well, it has this really beautiful chapel built in the middle of it. And so that's where I found it first, was, you know, the images of this cemetery with the white stone and the blue ocean beyond. And apparently the hurricanes have done a lot of damage there in the last couple of years. And so it's in fairly rough condition. But yeah, that this is the tourist thing that people tend to see, I find is really interesting, because they're not famous people buried there for the most part. But the tombs are really lovingly designed, and the sculpture is really beautiful.
Well, one person who was buried there became famous after death. There was a young, I believe it was a teenage mother, who died in childbirth, and her stillborn baby was buried at her feet. But then when they dug her up, and I don't know why they dug her up, they found the baby in her arms.
Isn't that a lovely story?
So the story goes. Mm-hmm. And because of that, people come to pray there for, I guess, a successful childbirth, right?
Right. Safety in childbirth. Yeah. There are a number of cemeteries around the world. I'm thinking of, in Barcelona, Poblenou, where there's another story similar, not mother and child, but they call him the little saint who is buried in the cemetery, and people have adopted his grave and come and visit him. He's not recognized by the church. You know, it's just a local belief, but I think the power of those stories is really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. You also, you started this by talking about the beauty of the temple there. When I was flipping through the book, I was really, really struck by a domed, a church in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Oh, yes.
It's called the Lakewood Cove Cemetery. It looks like it should be in Turkey.
Exactly.
It's extraordinary Byzantine architecture. How did that one come to be?
Different cemeteries have looked for ways to make themselves stand out. And it's a Christian, designed at least as a Christian chapel for people to come and do funerals at. But it's based on I'm going to mispronounce this, the Hagia Sophia. In Constantinople or Istanbul. And I think that's really lovely that whoever designed this gravitated toward the beauty and the sentiment behind it and not necessarily the history of it. And yeah, you'd think Minneapolis is a strange place for that, but somebody saw the original and just the beauty struck their heart.
They really created it. And it had nothing to do with people being of Turkish descent buried
there. Not at all. No,
yeah,
not at all.
Just somebody who liked that style of architecture. Mm-hmm. So you can get a little taste of Istanbul in the middle of Minneapolis. Who knew?
And it's really spectacular. The mosaic that covers the ceiling has gold leaf, you know, and it just sparkles in the light. It's really incredible.
Yeah, no, it sounds it. And the photo is beautiful. You also write about the Grand Canyon Pioneer Cemetery, which is not in the Grand Canyon. It's right nearby. And what struck me about that one was how intertwined the people who are buried there were with the history of tourism in that area, right? Can you tell us a little bit about some of the folks who were buried there?
Oh, it's fascinating. The people who opened the original hotels along the Valley Rim, the guides that led people into the valley in the early years started the mule trains.
Yeah, the first guide was so great, apparently such an amazing storyteller, that when Teddy Roosevelt visited, he requested him, "I want that guy."
Exactly, specifically, yes.
Yeah.
The history of water rights is recorded in the cemetery because one guy built a hotel, but his rivals cut off the water to it. So he had this beautiful building, but people couldn't stay there because there wasn't any water. Painters that recorded cemeteries on the brain here.
The nature of it, or?
Yeah, people who recorded the canyon and the native people in their paintings and photography are buried in the cemetery. And one of the things that I find particularly sad is there's a monument to a plane crash where two pilots detoured over the canyon so that people could look out the windows of the plane to see it and collided. And hundreds of people were killed in the air and on the ground when the planes crashed.
I had no
crashed.
Idea that happened. So that was in the 1950s, was
yeah.
it? When these So they went off course for a joyride to see the Grand Canyon from the sky, and they crashed, and that was it. Yeah, that was really surprising that I'd never heard about that before. You also talk a little bit about Greenwood Memorial Park in Renton, Washington, which is notable because the great guitarist,
Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix. Yes. The great guitarist Jimi Hendrix ended up being buried there. Mm-hmm. What's the story behind his? And it's a flashy looking grave, I gotta say.
It really is, yeah. When Hendrix died suddenly as a young man, there wasn't any money to give him much of a monument. His father brought him home and he was buried in a regular grave with a brass plaque, just a simple brass plaque over it. And for years, that's where he lay. But, oh, I'm going to blank the man's names. We're a pair, the two of us.
That's okay.
The guy who opened the music project in Seattle contacted Hendrix's father and helped him get the musical rights back, the rights to the music that Hendrix had written.
Right.
For years had gone to his manager, had gone to the record company, but the Hendrix family didn't get any of that. And so they got that straightened out. They got the rights reverted to the family. And then there was money to build this amazing, just incredible, looks like a granite gazebo. And it's the by far the grandest thing in the cemetery. It's a pretty quiet little neighborhood cemetery with this enormous monument in the middle of it.
Right.
And there's a life-size portrait of Hendrix and lyrics from his songs in his handwriting engraved on it. Mm. And when I was there, people were leaving guitar picks, you know, kind of in tribute to him.
Yeah, thousands of people still come. To leave tributes to Jimi Hendrix there.
And it's just a little out of the way graveyard.
Yeah.
That's so worth the visit.
Yeah, that's what was so remarkable about this book. You realize that in many destinations across the United States, across Europe, if you just take a little extra time to visit the local graveyard, you're going to learn a heck of a lot about that community, about the history.
That's what makes it so fascinating to me is, you know, everywhere you go, there's a graveyard. Honestly, every single place you go, there is a graveyard or somebody's buried there.
Except in Asia, because that's not so much part of their traditions. And you, when you're talking about a famous cemetery in Tokyo, you talk about that wasn't created until very recently, right? I mean, how did a cemetery come to a country that didn't have cemeteries previously?
Well, they do. Cemeteries in Japan were pretty much all temple based.
Huh.
So they're not very big, but generations are buried there. Because people are cremated, you can fit a lot of people in a grave.
Right.
But one of the things that fascinated me the first time I visited Tokyo was our host, who was Japanese, took us through this park near his home, and there were graves kind of back in the trees, you know, in between the playgrounds and the meadows and everything. And I said to him, you know, why is this here? And he said, well, there's samurai graves. The samurai were buried on their own property. And when the city took it over as a park, they couldn't move them. You know, that would be disrespectful. So they're still there. But Soshigaya, the one you're talking about, dates to the Meiji era, which is it's equivalent to our Victorian era.
Uh-huh.
And it was the start of public graveyards, not affiliated with temples.
Huh.
And so they're actually not very big, the public graveyards, but they're beautiful, beautifully landscaped. Soshigaya itself is just so crammed full of graves that pretty much the only greenery you see there are things that people, families have planted, hedges or trees or whatever.
Right.
But one of the other cemeteries in Tokyo that isn't in the book is Aoyama Ryen, which is this enormous hill that's just gorgeous. And it's one of the places people go in the spring to see the cherry blossoms.
Mm.
So, you know, Tokyo isn't really known for its large parks, but it does have these graveyards tucked in that are just as beautiful and full of bird song.
Yeah. And you learn about burial traditions sometimes in surprising ways in Japan. I was staying at a ryokan, which is a traditional Japanese lodging where you are sleeping in a room with tatami mats and you have to go outside of the room and down the hallway to take a bath. And so I was wearing the robe that they loan you when you stay in this place. And the owner of the home, when she saw me walking in the robe towards the bath, kind of cried aloud, came running over to me. And I was naked under the robe because I was going to the bath. Opened up my robe and retied it because I was I had it the wrong way. I had it the way that robes are tied right before a body is cremated. And so that is very, very bad luck to be tying your robe on that side. So I got exposed, but for a good reason, I guess.
You learned a lesson.
I learned a lesson. That's
one of the reasons you don't stick your chopsticks in your rice. Because when the offering is given to the picture during the funeral or later on the grave, you put the chopsticks point down into the rice so that the dead person can eat it. And so it's really disrespectful if you're at a restaurant and you stick your chopsticks into the rice. You know, it's much better to lay them on the side.
You also talk about a couple of cemeteries in Europe. One of them was Étretat-Saint-Maclou in Rouen, France. And I always wondered how decoration with bones in chapels came to be. And you tell the story of how it came to be in this city. So can you talk a little bit about that city, the bubonic plague, what happened with the cemeteries there?
Yeah, that's a fascinating place. During the Middle Ages, when the Black Plague was raging, you know, people would fall by the hundreds. I think they say 1/3 of everyone in Europe died. So just very quickly, huge amounts of numbers of bodies, and they had to be buried in mass graves with quicklime. There just wasn't time to do anything else. And so in Rouen, this atrium is just a little square. It's not very large, has a colonnade on three sides. And that was where the plague pit was. And, you know, basically they opened the ground, they put everybody in it, threw some lye in it, threw some dirt on it, and buried the next layer of people. And so it was just masses of people. And, after the plague and things settled down, they dug the bodies out of the dirt and put the bones into the ossuary surrounding. So the carvings on this former ossuary are spades and mattocks and skulls, and coffins, crossbones, all kinds of incredible stuff. And these plague pits were common in every city in Europe. This is the only one that still survives. So yeah. The bodies have all been moved now. The ossuary has been emptied and the ground is free of bodies. They've all been moved and reburied. But
right.
And there's a restaurant there and a art college and different things like that. But it's this beautiful little place full of all this history. And it's recorded on the walls, which I just think is really cool.
Yeah, and we'll end with one that kind of ties Europe with the United States. In Flanders Field, the American cemetery there, Flanders Field was a very famous battleground during World War I. In fact, probably the most famous poem to come out of that war is about Flanders Field. And there is an American cemetery which was given for free by the Belgian government to the United States. And what happens there yearly? I thought this was so moving.
Every year, the Belgian school children come and sing on, I believe it's Armistice Day. They come and sing to the memory of the American soldiers that gave their lives there. Yeah. And, you know, it's World War I doesn't really figure into our Memorial Day celebrations or even Veterans Day. We don't remember World War I, but
as
there
much, sure.
In Belgium, you know, it's still living history, and they still celebrate every year all these people who died so they could be free.
Right, and they're singing the children are singing the Star Spangled Banner, right?
So which I think is just amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
In English, they sing it in English.
Yeah.
And the little red poppies that you see for Veterans Day or whatever come from Flanders Field, because the year after the battle, which is just horrific, chemical weapons and trench warfare and, you know, brutal and ugly and horrible. And the year after the battle ended, the poppies sprouted all across the battlefield. And so that's why the poppies symbolize all those people that died.
Well, once again, it's a wonderful book. It's called 222 Cemeteries to See Before You Die. Thank you so much, Lauren, for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that is it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I, I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.